Okay, good morning. We have our study sheets here. Okay, we have our...
Impressive.
Yeah, right. You know the old me. The new me. And we're going to look at some verses from Perek Lamed Zayin, chapter 37 in Bereishit, just to use it as a paradigm or a model of what I do in my teaching at JTS, previously in other places. Basically thinking about the relationship between close reading, sensitivity to details, and the meaning that can be derived. I think a close reading for people, for many people, even without the meaning, can be spiritually elevating. And I think by being sensitive to these details and identifying them, it allows us to derive the meaning. As I said yesterday in the session, it's almost counterintuitive, like looking at these little technical details that some people can find off-putting actually allows you to just move into the deeper level of the text. So let's do it. And in a certain sense, I learned much of this from my teacher, Nachama Leibovich. And let's begin. You know the story? Yaakov favored Yosef. Remember that? And gave him a special cloak. Yosef had all these dreams. The brothers didn't care for him. He had one dream, two dreams, and they decided it's time to get rid of him. And that's where we're going to take up the story. But before that, instead of having you review the stories, because I got to be really careful with time today, just let's turn to the page. There's no numbers here, but most of the sources will have numbers. It's the third page where it says Nachama Leibovich on top. So this will be our technique number one. We're going to go through a lot of techniques, those that I learned from Nachama, those that I thought of myself, those that people do in general. So we're going to start with the first one, which is epithets. In other words, kinuyim in Hebrew, or how people are referred to in the text. And she and others feel it's very important. For example, you can read this little article of hers at home, where she gives examples where paying attention to the epithets can help you derive the meaning. For example, in the story of the banishment of Hagar and Ishmael. Ishmael is once called Na'ar, one time it's called Yeled, Ben Hagar HaMitzrit, and paying attention to these details are important since we take the approach, it's not necessarily arbitrary. Okay, so keeping that in mind, go to your next page, and I have a list of epithets for you. Rooms have been changed. See all those epithets? It says source number 2 in the upper left-hand corner. All the epithets in these verses. One day I just sat down and said, wow, look at all these. They might mean something. It's called the dreamer, him, brothers, etc. So this will be a way, just take 5 minutes. What I'm going to do is something educationally not very sound. I'm going to be rushing you through all these examples just so we can get a more global sense. So I'll ask you to do a really quick, as many as you can. You can use those first two pages where you have an overview. And notice the epithets on the other page. I want you to think for a while. Talk to someone sitting next to you. You won't have a lot of time. Pick a few of the epithets, the verse, and think what that epithet means. Why is he called dreamer in verse 19? Why in verse 30 is he called the child? Why is he called Joseph 3 times in verse 28? These type of things. Pick a couple of them. And think about it.
Three, yeah.
Okay, let's just share a few ideas, because again, we have so many things to do. Just want you to get a sense of the method. What do you think? Share a couple that you especially liked. And by the way, really brief answers, like I said yesterday, like no more than a sentence. Thank you, Andy.
So, him. It's the brothers every time. They never use his name.
Why? What do you think?
What is he personalized?
That's what many suggest. You know, when you're going to kill someone, you have to have this distancing and depersonalization. So perhaps, what else?
The switch to using his name is right before they're planning to kill him. Right before they kill him.
When is it used?
It's used to describe him before you throw him in the pit. The narrator. It's a narrator for us.
Okay, so that's what, if I had it, I used to say, very good, that's the narrative voice, Joseph, but there was one problem. In verse 33...
That's Jacob.
Right, and that supports the idea the brothers were unable to even utter his name. So it's only in the objective narrative voice when it's Joseph and Jacob who could.
But Judah gets closer by saying, our brother.
Exactly. Why does he say our brother? Because he has to convince him. How can you kill our brother? Nice. We'll do one more. 30. Sure.
No, I was going to say 27 reminds me of the Akedah, the change... Him, our brother, our flesh, kind of an intensification of the relationship and the drama of it.
The use of different epithets. So I'm going to take that, the use of different epithets, if you look at 33. Before we do 30, look at 33. Yeah, Lama Gimel, Jacob, when he hears that Yosef has died, what does he say? Ketonet b'ni, aya ra'a achalat hu, tarof toraf Yosef. He goes from my son to him to Joseph. Three different epithets. Mean anything? What is Mark saying? Yes, or just or noticing it?
It's like he's losing the relationship first. His son. And that's what, you know, if someone, God forbid, loses their son, I think their instinctive reaction, I've lost my child, my son. And that it's the relationship they've lost, the person in relationship to them that they've lost.
Okay.
Well, there's also, it depends on the object there. So so my son is connected to the coat that he gave.
Right.
Right. And the wild beast is devouring him. Well, okay, that's sort of stark, it's distant. And then Joseph is really returned, once again, returning to the personal.
He's
going through the phases and where he finally builds up to be able to say his name.
Interesting. I've had some people suggest it. It's kind of like almost like the stages of mourning. We're in source number two, looking at all the different epithets for Joseph. We'll be moving on to something, changing the pace. It's as if it's my son, shock, him distancing, Joseph, reality. That's what I have people suggest. You know, last point, because I can't resist. Is 30 the child?
Yeah,
Reuven comes. Why when Reuven speaks? Look at verse 30. Vayashav el echa vayomar hayeled einenu v'ani ana aniva.
Well, he's the oldest.
Ah, so that's one possibility. He's the oldest. Another possibility? Just make it up. Why is Reuven calling him Yeled?
His sensitivity to Joseph's, he and Yehuda, their greater sensitivity to Joseph's immaturity.
Okay, so it's interesting. You're placing, which works well in the story, Reuven and Yehuda are both using different epithets. Interesting.
The thing that also tried to save him initially.
Exactly. Depending which story. I thought you were going to say something.
No, the child is savable.
For a child is savable, which brings us to number three. What happens is, once you get sensitized to the questions, I find in the methodology, when you're speaking with the commentators, modern, ancient, and whatever, we've noticed this detail, and we're going to see it with another 10 little things, maybe. And the Netziv is number three. He's addressing the same thing. Look at the, he says, Reuven comes. Just look at the bolded words. You have everything in English.
Sorry, where are we?
Source number three. You see, the sources are numbered on the left-hand bolded box. So what does the Netziv think? Uferu show, shekol zeh eino ela maaseh yeldut, v'chein kara uto bazeh lashon hayeled einenu. He sees it, how Reuven is viewing Yosef. He says, oh, that foolish, childish, look what he's look the trouble he's gotten himself into. So it's more how Reuven sees Joseph's perspective, how he's viewing Joseph as opposed to his responsibility. So it's a different take, and they're all doing this. I don't have time, I wish I did. Joseph, verbatim repetition, an interesting technique we have here. In verse 20, the brothers say, let's kill him, and what will we tell our fathers? Chaya ra'a achalatu. What did Jacob just say when they brought him the cloak? Chaya ra'a achalatu. Verbatim repetition. The brothers planning say that, and Joseph said the same three words. It would be interesting to hear your thoughts, but don't think about it at all.
Actually, but they don't say it. Jacob says it.
They both know. They
don't tell Jacob.
No, of course not.
Well,
that's the point.
Right.
That's the whole point. That he uses the exact same three words that the brothers said when they were planning.
He saw it on Facebook.
What?
He saw it on Facebook.
He saw it on Facebook? Well, that's... But I don't want to talk about it. So let's go to source number four. So the brothers are planning. That's what we talked about it. Just we talked about. Source number four, verse... And we'll see what happens to his dreams. A technique that I find very interesting is one of dramatic reading. Asking my students, talk to the person next to you, be friendly, just take a minute, think of two possible dramatic readings, and I'd like to hear you do it, those who will volunteer, but not explaining how you do it, but doing of the last of four words, two possible dramatic readings based on your understanding of the text. Maybe we do have an even amount of people. Maybe why don't Dennis and Mark?
Let's see how it's going.
Whereas mine, I mean, the third island is full of chocolate.
Maybe have one is.
We'll see what happens. No way. So their attitude towards us.
Maybe they're
Okay, time's up. The brothers, verse 20, the brothers say, let's kill him, and we'll see what happens in his dreams. Volunteer for a dramatic reading. I'm doing this just to show you how to think about the methodology.
Let's look into his dreams.
That's what most people would say. Right? It's kind of like sarcastic. But here, Ed, what's another possibility?
Let's see how his dreams will come true.
That's actually a Ramban. You can see the Ramban suggests that. That's the one that he actually favors, if I understood yours correctly. Because another interesting technique is go to the commentators and then ask students, do your dramatic reading, ask them which commentator you think he's doing. And I think you're doing Ramban. Let's see. So we're going to skip Rashi and we'll see why we're going to come back. Look at source number six. The first one I have in English and Hebrew again. That's what we all say, kind of derisive. We'll see after he's dead if we're going to battle him. But number two, look what he says. He understands that's a possibility. He's sensitive to the multivalent nature of the text. And he's known for bringing more, one, two, three. He says, in other words, it was a controlled experiment because they believed in the efficacy of dreams. Is that what you were saying? That's what it sounded like.
Yeah, but on some level they believed in dreams.
Exactly, some level. And someone say, let's get it over with, we'll find out. You know, we'll see if it happens. So those are what?
Test.
Exactly. That's the possibility.
You test the armor by just shooting the person and then seeing if the armor works.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Means Captain America.
That's nice. Could use that in your teaching. Now let's go back to Rashi. Let's think about what Rashi does. Rashi, back in source number 5, the previous page, Nirem Mayim Chalamutta, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, it's not Rashi, it's Midrash, Ruach HaKodesh Omer Gein. It's not the brothers, it's the Holy Spirit. Im Omrim Nahargeim. They say, let's kill him. Hakatuv Mesayim, but the text concludes, Nirem Mayim Chalamutta, Nirem Dvar Miyakum, Moshe Lachem, Moshe Lachem. And Rashi says, it's impossible that the brothers could be saying it, or whatever. So Rashi's staging is something like this. If I had to stage it, it's another question I'd like to ask. It's a little different from dramatic reading, but it's in the same kind of ballpark. I would stage it as something like perhaps a Greek chorus or Shakespearean aside. As the brothers are getting ready to kill him, you have Nirem. We'll see. In other words, we know what's going to happen. That's what I think Rashi's doing. In the end, if I were to stage it, I like Rashi's pshat, I would stage it as simultaneously. The brothers are saying it, and you get the simultaneity of the Shakespearean aside, so to speak. I shared this when I lived in Yerushalayim, and Mark knows I lived in Yerushalayim, because at Pardes where I taught. I shared this with Lisa Zornberg because I was pleased with myself. And she said, I have a better one for you. She said, go to the Netziv. And she sent me here to the Netziv. And if you know Aviva Zornberg, you'll see why she liked the Netziv's understanding. The Netziv says, and we're going to do something that you need to think about. I'm going to give you another example after this, where many of the commentators don't take Rashi's comments literally, understanding that the style of the Midrash is very concrete. And you need to understand that they are conceptualizing. For people interested, we meet Susan Handelman, Slayers of Moses. She has a wonderful chapter on how to understand the style of the Midrash. They didn't have
Moses.
Slayers of Moses.
Slayers.
Oh. Talking to him quickly. Because the rabbis did not have abstract terminology, but they were speaking in conceptual terms. So the modern readers sometimes miss it. So many of the commentators, certainly the 19th century, will say, no, don't take it literally. What Rashi says, the Holy Spirit, what does that mean? Take a look at number 7, and we'll see how Hamet Tavar understands it. I'll read a little bit in Hebrew. You have it in English as well. Ayin Perish Rashi, he says, B'shem HaMidrash, source number 7. Ein HaKavanah Shelo Amru Achim Devarim Eilu. It doesn't mean the brothers didn't say that. That's not what Rashi means. Are you all there? The Ein HaKavanah Shelo Amru Achim Devarim Eilu Klal El Ruach HaKodesh Ophia. Doesn't mean the Holy Spirit appeared. The E of Shalom Marke. That makes no sense. And he goes on. Dvimanashech. Im Shamu Achim Habat Kol. The brothers heard the Holy Spirit. V'chishotim hayul aloch neged dat alyon. Wouldn't they have gone against the Holy Spirit? V'im lo shamu mazem udinim. And if they didn't hear it, what does it teach us? You can read it more slowly. What did he say in the end it means? Look at the last two lines. Middle of the line, it says, Omnam the text is coming to teach us something. You need to listen sometimes to the words you say, especially when they're unplanned. He's talking about a Freudian slip in a certain sense. And what he's saying, what is the bat kol? It's your voice, it's your inner voice that you need to listen to. So that's what he says Rashi means by Ruach HaKodesh. It takes an entirely different take. And if you know Aviva's work, you can see why she went for this psychologically oriented. But you should know in the 19th century, and Ramban, we're going to go to Ramban so you can understand this. Because for me, for studying Rashi, it has an important dimension when you can think that you don't always have to take it literally. Because sometimes people say, where did he get that from? The commentators were already doing that. Therefore, I want to skip to a Ramban in this chapter, but it's to the end. It's at the end. It's source number 43. Okay. Joseph gets lost. See source number 43? His father sends him. Look at number 15. Pasuk 15 in source 53. Vayin tzei, ish, v'yim tu'er ha-savir. V'yishalei ha-ish le'imor. Matavakei, the man finds him. What's going on? Are you lost? What are you looking for? V'yomer, etachai anochi mevakesh. Hagida ni le'yefo heim ro'im. V'yomer ha-ish, nasu mizeh, ki shamati amrim ne'elecha dotana. V'yelech Yosef elechal. V'yim tzei netotan. Okay. Get this whole long story. Look at 44. Vayimsa Ehu Ish. What does Rashi say? Ze Gavriel. The angel Gavriel found Joseph. That's who the Ish is. That's how Yosef identifies, Rashi identifies the Ish, following in the footsteps of the Midrash. What I'm going to ask you to do now is do a little chavruta. It can take a 3-minute chavruta, take a little bit longer time. I want you to see how Rambam deals with this section, and this will be another level of our methodology of comparing and contrasting terminology, also considering about the conceptualization. Interpretation number one of Ramban is the first paragraph. Interpretation number two, I'd like you to think especially about B, D, E. They're linked. B, D, E are linked. What's the difference between these two answers? First stage, which will be literary, and then D and E. Okay, so let's go for B, D, and E.
That's the prevailing.
right, so these so these guys appear in the red. The point of the text becomes
Okay, whatever. Do you know whatever? Whatever you've done is okay. Ready? This is actually this reminds me of when I first began teaching at Pardes in Israel many years ago. And the students said, okay, we're going to have an hour and a half from Beit Midrash. I said, what will we do there? And then, as the weeks went by, you try to call them back into the class. So what did you think? And again,
We're not done.
I know you're not, but I'm not. I got all these more things. If we ask the first question, this was Makama later, which is second favorite question. Our most famous was Makashel to Rashi. What's Rashi's textual difficulty? Our second one that she used to ask us, she used to tell us, ask this a lot, Maha Hevdel. She felt it was a powerful tool to help you refine skills of analysis. What's the difference between A and B? And that's why I ask, and how you have to play the game was you have to come up with parallel answers. Otherwise, it's just, it's not working. That's how she forced us to play the game. And forced is the correct word. What is the difference between Ramban's two interpretations?
The first one is all about human agency. The forces come to help you when you make your decision. And then the second one is all about human agency doesn't count for much. It's all that the forces that come to guide you are divinely.
All right, nice. I think there's two possibilities there. We can have, and we see this in the commentators, the first one could be seen as a text on the human level, and the second one on the divine level. And another way of framing it could be the first one could be the text, and the second one is the subtext. It's almost like wanting us to become sensitive. It's just different framing. Another way could be perspective, one of my favorite words. And if you forget the God thing for the minute, we can read it from the perspective of different characters. First one is the perspective of Joseph. We're being told he was a good son. We learn something about Kibbutz Av. He did it no matter what. The second one is more about God. God had his plans. This is how he works. That's why the story, you have to understand what these men were. They were angels.
So I'm not looking to throw Yosef under the bus, and I was here a little late. But why do we have to believe that he persisted because of Kibbutz Av?
We don't.
Okay.
We don't.
He's being guided.
It could be his delight in tattling.
Well,
that he endured everything, that he continued. I mean, it could say many things about his character, I suppose.
And I think Deborah was going in that direction. When I asked the question about what's the possible implied theology, one of my students helped me see this, and I think that's what Deborah was actually saying. There's a tension between, is there free will or is there not? As you said, is it human agency or divine agency? And the first one saying, you know why he went? Because he persisted. He had a lot of excuses. He had a lot of good reasons. He was lost. The second one is, oh, God controls it all. So I think there's a certain tension there. And looking closely helps us think about these issues. Andrew, you want to say
that's a big issue in the whole Joseph story.
Exactly.
I mean, that is Joseph's thing. No, you didn't send me here, God did.
Exactly. He says it explicitly.
Yes.
Really nice. It's not you, and they think it's them. One other thing over here is, who are the angels? According to Ramban. Why did I bring this Ramban? Because, as I said, there are other commentators who stand back and say, no, don't take it literally. So he says, what do the rabbis mean when they say angels? They don't mean angels. They mean people. That we are the one that are part of the plan, and that anyone can be an angel. Look what he says. No, I've read it. first line, though. Kizimelo, end of the first line of the second paragraph. God prepared for them. Kizimelo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moreh Derech Shalom Midato Lahavio Biyadam. God prepared a Moreh Derech, a human angel, and there's two ways of reading it. Either Yosef didn't know, or the people didn't know. In other words, who's the angel? Any of us may be that divine messenger. So I think he's speaking about that as well, or at least Mahamalevich thought so. Let's move this on. If we had time, I would talk about the first paragraph. Ramban, yes.
Does Moreh Derech always mean Shalom Dato?
No. God prepared Moreh Derech, a guide, someone to guide him. Shalom Dato, without his having known. According to the Muhammad, without the angel.
So we see Moreh Derech, a phrase could be used to refer to someone who is self-aware of their role.
No, not necessarily. He doesn't say God prepared Shalom Dato. Depends who the Shalom Dato refers to. According to the Muhammad, means the angel doesn't know. That any of us, we can be angels for other people in their lives. Okay? Let's move back to one of my most favorite principles. I find it really fascinating. If you turn, we'll go back where we left off to source number 8, called the Vayomer principle. Or in academic literature, they give it a fancy name, the iterated quotation formula. Source number 8 for the Vayomer phenomenon, a fascinating literary technique to be sensitive to in the Torah. You have one character speaking, source number 8. And you get another Vayomer. So let's go back. The brothers say, let's kill him. Source number 8, you all with me? Vayishmaru Ruvain Vayatzilein Miyadam. Ruvain heard, and he all translated, tried to save him. Vayomer. So what did he say to his brothers? Loma kenu nafesh. We're not going to kill him. Vayomer Alayam Ruvain, but he's still speaking. See how I bolded that Vayomer? Why do we get a second Vayomer? Al tishpichu dam, hashpichu oto al habor hazeh, asher b'midbar, v'yad al tishlichu vo, l'man hatziloto miyadam, lashivo el aviv. Just think for a second, we don't have time for more kavuchas, which would have been lovely. You get 1 minute to think about why there's a second Vayomer, the difference between the two of them. Then we'll see how the Netziv and the Malbim, 19th century again, argue it out and share their, and we'll look at their interpretations. Why do you think there's a second Vayomer? Any difference between the two? Any thoughts? Sure.
Does it hint to a conversation between them?
Maybe. There's something missing between the two, you're saying. Mm-hmm. That's how many of the commentators, not all, think the Vayomer principle works. It means there's something missing between the two Vayomers, and it may have been, as Ramban, who we're not going to look at, but is on your sheet, suggests, Ruvain had a lot of other things that didn't work. Said a lot of other things that didn't work. This was the one that finally worked, and we don't need to record it. Any other suggestion?
Is source criticism appropriate here? Because
it's appropriate anywhere.
because this whole scene is very, very confused, and Ruvain and Judah.
Well, Ruvain and Judah, for sure, source criticism is one of the bases.
No, exactly. So that's why, I'm not looking at it in its entirety here, but I'm just wondering
if these two verses,
simple way out.
I don't know if they deal with it. It wouldn't be any fun.
Yes, that's why I asked for permission.
You can think of it as retreating from an initial position of virtue. It's, first, standing up and saying, don't kill him. And it's like, all right, we can throw him into the pit.
You looked at Malby. Just teasing.
I remember this actually from my second grade Parshanut class. Believe it or not, I had a great Parshanut class when I was in the second grade.
I don't remember anything with the second grade.
Baruch Haya. But I don't remember if it was Malby, but notion of...
A lot of different possibilities. So we're going to just look and see what the commentators do and what they noticed. You're going to notice some of them will also notice that the first one is in who's been speaking in the first person. We're not going to kill him. The second one, we have an Aleihem, speaks to them, and now he's speaking in the first person, plural, don't you kill him. So they're going to base their interpretation on these small details that they've noticed. Let's look at the Netziv, source number 9. You know what? I'm going to save time. You don't need to hear me read the Hebrew. I'm going to ask you, just by yourselves, read the Netziv, read the Malbim in English, and think about them. You know what? I take it back. I'm going to read it just so you hear it. That'll take you through. You can look at it in English as I'm doing the Hebrew, or look at the Hebrew. Look at Tzif Vayomer Aleihem. He notices that detail. It doesn't say Vayomer Aleihem. Kmo Bikrat HaSamuch, as in the adjacent verse. Ela Mitchila, so why? Bar Reuven B'kol Rash Gadol. Dramatic reading. U'medaber El Atzmo. So he starts out, that's his thing. We're not going to do it. Once they got the message, then he said, don't spill blood. Throw him in the pit. Okay. That's Nitziv. Let's look at Malbim. Malbim does the following. Along the line of Deborah's interpretation. Says, first he tried to save him completely. When that didn't work, he lowered the ante. He says, okay, at least, you know, let's not kill him outright, so to speak. This is how he's reading it. And then he lowers it even more. Well, at least, let's not be out my confusion. The next one is, don't kill him directly. And he has, what's his pregnant clause of the space? Their lack of response. Malbim says, they didn't listen to that. So it's his speaking, and they're not responding until finally they respond when he lowers the ante to, we can't kill him directly, at least. We've got to do what? Throw him in the pit, let it happen on his own. We can't do that. Turn to the next page. If you compare the Netziv and the Malbim, look at numbers 2. In one word, parallel. If you can, if not, do a sentence. Describe Reuven's attitude and state of mind. According to the Netziv, HaMetzavar, and according to Malbim. Think about this a second.
Which number?
Oh, on the next page, there are these questions. Number C. Describe Reuven's attitude according to each of the different commentators in one word would be nice. According to HaMetzavar and Malbim. Describe how their state of mind.
Emotional, rational.
Say it again.
That the Netziv is describing it in a more emotional, Reuven is more approaching it in an emotional way, whereas Malbim, Reuven is approaching it in a more rational
way. Okay, I hear that. We'll talk about it in a second.
First, unsure of himself, sort of building his courage, and someone is selling or trying to convince.
Okay. Any other thoughts? How about if you link it with
Maybe the first is leader, and the second one is beggar.
Okay, that's interesting, because my number D is, which model of leadership do you prefer? It's kind of linked. And Nahama thought the first one was a strong leader, and the second one was, you know, a weaker type of leader. But when I taught this, Rafi, it was your year, my first year at JTS, and I taught this, and Utz Steyer, whose family had did some diplomatic work, said, no, Nahama's wrong. That Malbim was a great diplomat. He didn't give up. He didn't leave. He kept trying. He kept figuring out until he could find a way when they would agree. So she said, that's actually quite a fine model of leadership. It's not so weak as you think. Possibility. Another way of articulating it, perhaps, according to the Netziv, Reuven is proactive. According to the Malbim, he's reactive. Each time he says, okay, well, let's try this. Different ways of looking at it, thinking about it. Another example where we've seen a technique. And helped us think about the characters and then getting to take it to the level about thinking about leadership when I'm rushing this like crazy. Okay. Just by the way, the number 11, he takes it entirely psychological. The Sheikh says, Luthi had to think, they're going wild now. What am I going to do with, there's this mob mentality. So he says, first he may believe he was one of the guys. He said, leave. We can't do it. I'm with you. He said, once they calm down, he said, no, I'm not with you. He said, now I'm speaking to you directly, and don't you do it. We can't do something like that. So that's how he deals with it. He sees as a kind of like mob mentality, an entirely different level of leadership or thinking. Moving on. Another technique. We will skip 15 and 16. And 17 and 18. Well, let's go to 19. This is a kind of, a fun one. So they're not going to kill him. They're going to throw him in a pit. Joseph comes by. Verse number 19. Can you take in 1 minute, Chavruta, and just have all the questions together? I'm basically interested in how you would consider all the characters, staging. I would ask my students to translate it, because when you translate a powerful tool, when thinking about meaning and possibilities, think about translation, don't go overboard. Think about questions, think how you'd stage it, and consider all the characters. I'm especially interested in how you would stage it and thinking about all the characters. So, take 2 minutes. Would you enjoy one of them? Okay, may I bring us back just so you got a little sense? What we're going to do is think about narration from the perspective of the characters. By the way, narration is not always objective. We usually think of narration as an objective voice in literature in general, but it's not so. Frequently enough, narration transitions into subjective narration, and you need to understand the narrative details from the perspective of the characters. We're going to see the commentators doing that. That's why I asked you to stage it. If you had a theater workshop, you'd have to think about the questions I just asked you. How exactly would you stage this in the Joseph story? I haven't seen the Technicolor or whatever in a long time. I'd be interested in seeing how they staged it now that I'm thinking.
My son's in it as we speak.
Yes. What?
So I've been seeing it a lot.
The narrator plays a huge role.
What do you think?
The narrator is subjective in a sense. sense by saying a katona tepasiha basima share alav. He focuses on the origins of this whole episode.
Okay, katona hapasim, the repetition. These small details are going to be very nice. The commentators are going to deal with that. Asher Allah, where else was it? But except Asher Allah, why twice Katonet? Why all these ets type of thing? What does Vayev Shitu mean? We could spend another half hour just on this. Are we okay that I'm rushing us?
Well, there's another.
Do you have a choice? I realize that. Like,
are we blaming Yosef because he's the one who comes to them?
I don't know.
I mean, if we were to make a coup and just come strip you of your badge, all of us together, as I imagine the brothers just swarming around, then we could spend half an hour.
So the brothers.
You make the jokes. I love that.
Remember that. Very good. Last night they didn't remember that. Last night. So you have a whole group coming over stripping him.
Well, that's what I was trying to figure out.
Another suggestion that I stage you. The scene.
In a progression almost, that you know, they start off tearing it and then it becomes more vicious and more vicious because of the I have Shintu et Yosef and then et Ktunato and then et Ktunato Basim Asher Allah.
I feel that.
Yeah.
I feel that.
That's
nice.
It's hard to do. A lot, but it's almost as if they start hitting him, it starts ripping at his flesh.
Nice. One more possibility, or let's see what the commentators do. And they're all going to be basing it on Rashi's reading, classic Rashi. He must look at redundancies or Yitur Milim. He says, Et Kutonto, what's that? Source 20? 20 Zechaluk. That's his undergarment. 23, Et Ketonet HaPasim, Hu Shehosif Lo Aviv Yoter Alechav. That's a special extra one, so to speak, the outer one. Let's look at Kriyakar. Let's look at his stages. What does he say? He said, why? Rashi says it's the undergarment. So then why did he strip him of the undergarment? The order is a little out of order here. You notice it? Right. Rashi says, it should have said he stripped him of his ketonet tepasim and the kutonta. So you know what Kliyakar says? That's because, look at that first paragraph. Read it in English. This is an interesting staging. Would you like to read it in English?
Rashi explains that his cloak is his undergarment. So why did they strip him of his undergarment? Perhaps Joseph, when going with brothers, was afraid they would steal his ornamental cloak from him. Therefore, he did a childish thing and went and sewed and attached the ornamental cloak to his plain cloak because he thought they certainly wouldn't leave him naked. He didn't suspect them of such an extreme. Therefore, they stripped him also of his undergarment by way of ornamental tunic, and then et, what would mean with.
He says et doesn't only have to be the direct object indicator.
He anticipates being harassed.
Yes, he does, exactly.
They're going to harass.
This stage has Joseph walking all over here, I better do it. Then look what he says in the second one. And there are those who say, Dennis, did you read it?
Those who say that Joseph switched cloaks and placed the ornamented cloak on his body and the regular one he placed on top in order to hide the ornamented cloak one from his brothers. Therefore, it says his cloak, because first they stripped him of the regular cloak which was on top.
Okay, we can stop there. See what Kliyakar is doing? We're going to hold it. We'll look at Or HaChaim because I've got to get to a couple more examples in 3 minutes. Or HaChaim, source number 22. Volunteer to read in English? Please.
They stripped him of his tunic according to the plain meaning of the verse. The word katanto refers to his shirt or undergarment, whereas the additional words katanotapasim refer to his outer garment, the one his father had made for him. In order to understand the verse thoroughly, we have to know why the Torah did not write
katanotapasim. That would have made more sense.
Yeah.
But
the Torah wanted us to understand that the brothers did not want to strip Joseph naked. Their main concern was to remove the striped coat which had aroused their jealousy. The Torah tells us when they began to strip the striped coat of him, they were so angry at him that they inadvertently also removed his shirt at the same time. The Torah describes that Joseph was left naked by writing the stripped. They stripped him naked by unintentionally removing his shirt with his striped coat.
So they said that when they saw it, they lost control and they just stripped it all together. So my question is, how do their approaches differ? here's what I'd come up with, and we don't have time. I think what they're doing is perspective thing, which I like very much. That Kliyakar is reading these narrative details from Joseph's perspective. He's saying, oh, Joseph thought this, therefore Joseph switched it, he put the one on top, and he gets it based on these details. What does Or HaIm say? No, he reads it from the brother's perspective. He says it's the brothers. They went wild, they saw that quote, they got so angry they couldn't control themselves. So they're both doing psychological type of readings. Many of the commentators try to think about the psychology of the different characters and how do they get that? By the close details they're reading here. Now, if you think they're commentators, that these comments are fanciful, they may be, and they probably are, but nevertheless, what I like to show is they're doing what we need to do. They're trying to think about the staging. They're looking at the close details. Take it or leave it. Rashbam, oh, Angie, you want to say something? Rashbam, oh, look at Ibn Ezra, I can't resist, whatever. Ibn Ezra, he focuses on the history. Look at his staging. Someone like to read? Carol, would you like to read 23?
Abaye alluded to that they stripped is a causative. They told him to take the coat off by himself.
Stop, look at their staging. Their staging is take it off yourself. And then I asked a question again, how would you describe the brother's attitude according to Ibn Ezra? They're having him strip himself. Give me a word. No right answer, but it's...
It's even more humiliating.
Even more humiliating. I found that they're not stripping him and jumping on him and hurting him. Some people find that exceedingly... What was it?
And dig your own grave.
Yeah. So that was a very different way that Ibn Ezra's looking at it. But his, not surprisingly, what's his close reading? The Hifil form. That it's a Vayav Shitu. In other words, they caused him to be stripped, which could technically mean they caused him to be stripped, as well as they stripped him. And finally, look at Rashbam, our pshat man who always disagrees with his grandfather, Rashi, and says, don't give me all these things. Who'd like to read Rashbam? Who's a pshat person?
And there are those who explain that garment is mentioned here only to allude to its being the original cause of the hatred. This is incorrect.
No, he says it has nothing to do.
Rather, since the text says below that they sent the long jacket to their father to fool him so that he would imagine that a wild beast devoured him. As it is written, he recognized it and said, my son's jacket. Accordingly, the text mentions that same garment here.
How is Rashbam's approach different from everyone else's? In one word, what's the perspective? Whose perspective is he reading it from?
The brother.
Jacob. Well, he's considered of Jacob's perspective.
The readers. He's saying this is for us, the reader. He's foreshadowing. He said, you know why it's here? So we, the reader, can understand later on when the brothers bring the cloak to their father, where did it come from? And he's known for this. Martin Bluchshin, in his work on Rashbam, talks about that Rashbam being somewhat radical in the traditional world, saying that certain verses are there, not really for themselves. They don't have meaning in and of themselves, but they're anticipatory information, some stylistic device to help the reader. Okay, last thing, unfortunately, I only got so much more. The last one is the silence of the text. Let's move to, which is a powerful tool of interpretation, by the way, when people don't say anything. We dealt with that earlier when some suggest that Vayomer meant maybe something else was being said, but we're going to deal with the real silence. And to our last source, let's go to source number 37. Let's go to we do have 2 minutes. Source number 37. In chapter 37, what does Joseph say as they're stripping him and later they throw him in the pit? When you read it during your epithets, nothing. We don't hear a word from Joseph. From the time the brothers see him and they say, let's kill him, and they strip him, and we know that Joseph has no problem speaking, as we remember. But he gets himself into trouble, and later on he does well with words. But then we get to look at source 37. Chapter 42, 1922, 22 years later, Joseph is playing with him and saying, I've got to keep your brothers, you'll have to stay in jail, that's what's going to do, bring your other brother, whatever goes on there. And the brothers say, wow. Look at verse 20. Bring your youngest brother, you won't die if you do that. and they speak to each other by Yavrui Shalachiv, Hafarav. אבל השנים אנחנו על אחינו אשר ראינו צרת נפשינו בהתחננו אלינו. We're guilty. He was crying out to us. ולא שמענו. על כן באה אלינו הצרה הזאת. So 22 years later, this is what they say. So my question is, why do we not hear Joseph in 37? What's your interpretation? Then we'll end with Ramban's three possible interpretations.
Brother's conscience. So Joseph really doesn't have a place inside the brother's conscience.
In 37. That's what many suggest. Is it 37?
Yeah.
Or in 42? Chapter 37?
No, no, source. What we just read. So I guess it's chapter 42.
Oh, that now they have a conscience.
Right. We're hearing their conscience, so there's no place for Joseph to speak when we're hearing their conscience.
Okay.
Incidents, when they first happen, they go by so quickly. And in reflection, sometimes you go in depth into the details of what exactly happened.
We'll see one of Ramban's.
Perhaps there is a way to stand and be humiliated with dignity. And you maintain, you know, you keep eye contact and you maintain dignity while they are trying to humiliate you. And that may speak louder than a protest calling out.
I've heard some suggest that Joseph didn't speak. That he stood there because he believed that his dreams would be realized, and he just stood there. Suggest a couple other suggestions. You know why we don't hear Joseph in 37? Because that chapter is being told from the perspective of the brothers. And they didn't hear him, therefore there's no voice of Joseph. But years later, we hear the remorse. Although when I taught this a long time ago, when I did a little workshop at Brandeis and Joe Reamer, psychologists suggested, no, that doesn't mean that Joseph spoke, because we regularly create and recreate memories. The brothers may be now saying, oh, when he was crying out, we should have listened. But maybe he did cry out, maybe he didn't cry out. Let's conclude with the commentators. Verse 38, source number 38. Why didn't the Torah tell us in 37 talk about the screaming out, and it does in 42? Interpretation number one, Ramban gives three suggestions. Perhaps because it's so obvious, it's obvious that a brother would say, how could you kill me? How could you do this? What's going to happen to the family, to the father? It's so obvious, the text doesn't do it. Or number two, the text wanted to somehow mitigate. It would just be too much to mention that Joseph was screaming and they didn't listen. That would be more than enough. Or number three, as you just suggested, that's the style of the Torah text. In one place, you don't get the details. In another place, you do. It's a style of good literature in general. We don't know all the details all the time. And look at the last one, number 39. You can think of this at home. It's Oznaim LaTorah. We'd like to read them, and with that we conclude. And the lessons and the things you'll think, Andy.
The Torah's description of Joseph's sale mentions no pleading, but this is because compassion is such a basic Jewish trait that the brother's callousness to Joseph, he's just pleased, came in the ugliest act of the whole episode. The Torah, therefore, omitted mention of his pleading at the time and waited for the brothers themselves to admit the severity of their crime along with their repentance for it.
So it's juxtaposed here, one to mitigate, and to have this tshuva thing juxtaposed.
See, it's in film, actually. You see where it was like a scene, and then later on, they'll flash back to, you know, omitted detail. This is used all the time in television and film today.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a revelation. Like, oh my gosh, that's how bad it was. It's a very cinematic technique.
There's such a... Yeah, I taught this recently, and the amount of language at the story of the reconciliation is overwhelming, and when you now compare it with the terseness... Exactly. Of the crime, it's extraordinary. It's such an action-packed set of verses, and then you get this long, dispersive untangling of it. It's quite extraordinary.
You process all these too.
I'm going to say thank you very much.
And when you get home,
you've like lots more things over here. If you want, you can look through it. And
how many classes would you typically teach this in? I mean, over what period of time?
A lot.
That's very nice.
There you go. Thank you.